existing up here in a world that does not exist. It simply does not exist. So let's just talk a little bit about real human nature. There's something about our field, maybe because so many of us started out as journalists or writers, that I think sometimes draws us away from that. We've learned a lot of rules about how you do things. And I think we need to get into a mode, if we're going to have the impact inside the organization that I know we can, because we see it everywhere, we have to literally think differently than other people think. And believe it or not, we have to become illogical thinkers. Yeah, you heard me right. We have to become illogical thinkers. Because organizations are in difficulty every day due to logical thinking. Something is logical, but human nature ain't. And so we've got a logical management that postulates all these logical decisions. It makes sense. And we've got a world of people down here that don't care and that aren't. It's almost facts and perceptions clashing all over again. I mean, stop to think about how we make decisions, these logical decisions. The typical organizational decision is made on a model that goes something like this. First, of course, we appoint a committee or task force. That's first for every decision, right? And once we get the committee or task force appointed, they get some research done. Sometimes it stands up in a pile like this, you know, on the table, all these wonderful printouts. Then we lie like hell and claim we read and understood all that. Think about that. And then from this pile of data, we magically draw out all these logical conclusions and we apply them. The implication of that system, just think about it for a minute, are totally people crunching. And that's why a lot of the number crunching being done today is people crunching, because it assumes that people are similar, and we know they all have their own perceptions. Some people think it's a local call, you see? And so we've got this problem of organizations. Somebody in there has to be the one who says, wait a minute, they're people. They're not going to act like that. Let's get realistic. Hey, boss, you're very pragmatic and practical. You want this to work. And if you want it to work, let's get down where the people are that have to work it. Because remember, management is getting things done with people. The publics out there are people. The staff inside, it's people. So we have to look at this whole question of illogical decision-making, meaning something may be logical, but are people going to respond to it? Is it going to work with people? I suggest to you that the only folks in most organizations that are thinking that way are the public relations practitioners. And I think it's our job to think that way, and I think if you were to ask me, what is there about your profession that is its unique selling proposition? Why are you different than the lawyers, the planners, the marketers, the advertisers, the managers? The difference is that we think in terms of human nature. And the first question we always ask is, will people do it? Now, that doesn't mean that sometimes we shouldn't ask people to raise their sights and be big about things. I'm not talking about playing always to the lowest common denominator. I'm talking about the realities. Remember, we're after desired behavior, remember? That behavior is by people. Well, if you want to teach people a behavior, you got to know the people. Let me see if I can illustrate this for you in a more practical way. How do you make illogical decisions? And is this something that we do? Is it true that people are illogical? Well, let's try it out on you. You're people. I mean, even if you work for Bank of America, you're still people, right? Okay. What's the most important decision that someone makes in their life? Well, probably, I suppose, the most important decision is who we're going to spend our time with. Our spouses, what is it that the census now calls them? They have a wonderful term. Yeah, well, significant other is one, but... apostle Q, right. People of opposite sex sharing living quarters. That's it, the apostle Q. Beg pardon? Yes. Well, I guess that's probably the most important decision. So let's, first of all, let's do a little research here. How many of you have a spouse or significant other, special friend, whatever you call it? Okay. Anybody have both? Both spouse and a special friend? All right, now just ask yourself this question. Did you choose that person logically? What did you do? Force field analysis? Decision tree, maybe? Did you run it in the computer? It's ridiculous, isn't it? We wouldn't think of that. Or if any of you did, you know, I know the name of a good divorce lawyer who can probably help you work it out. Here's the most important decision we're ever going to make, or today you have to say decisions because it's kind of a serial thing in modern American life. The people we're going to spend all this time with, we're going to share our worldly riches, and we're going to probably have families and so forth, and we would not think of bringing to that most important of all decisions this thing called logic. And yet when we go to work, we check all that at the door, and bang, we're going to get logical. Not really. Well, let's take it a step further. So you find a significant other and you have a family. What do? When the kids get to be five, do we apply organizational logic? And we call Johnny in and we say, Johnny, you're 5 years old, time for a performance review. You know, you don't keep your room very well. You're pretty good on the family softball team, but I mean, you're just not cutting it out. Back to the minors. You can't be in his family. See, that's logical thinking. But take some even less important decision. How do people buy houses? You get married, you have a family, and the next thing you want to do when you've saved up a little money and you can get the bank to give you a mortgage, or I guess that's the old days, isn't it, when banks gave mortgages, you get the bank to handle your paperwork for a Fannie Mae. When you do that, how do you buy the house? Well, now, if I were to ask you all to write down a piece of paper why you bought your house or rented your apartment or whatever it is you're doing, I know what you'd tell me, because it's never failed. People, the ones who do the cooking in the family say, well, it was like this. In the kitchen, the stove was right here, and the sink was right here, and the refrigerator was right here, and it's just a step for each, and it's so quick and convenient. Or they'll say the closet space was wonderful, or the room size. You know, that is all sheer hogwash. That is not why those people bought the house. Let me tell you why people buy houses. It has nothing to do with logic, believe me. The National Association of Realtors has been studying this since the 1940s. I guess I don't need that S. And they say the reason people buy houses is curb appeal. Here's how it works. You get in the car with the real estate salesperson. You ever notice they always want you in their car so they have a captive audience? And then they drive you over to the house. And of course, that's a trick too. They are very careful to go by circuitous ways so you don't go past any competing real estate salesperson's signs out front. And they go through all that and they're yak, 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 and you get about a half a block away and they're still yakking at you, and all of a sudden total silence sets in. If they're well-trained real estate people, this is exactly how they're trained. Total silence about a half a block away from the house, and they focus on that prospect. And they intensely watch the facial and body language. And if when you pull up to the house, people go, oh. In other words, if the curb appeal is positive, people go, oh, man, they stop and they've got you inside that place in 2 seconds flat. But if they go, oh, not what I expected, then they don't even stop. They zip away from the curb and you say, you know, you're right. I don't think that's the one for you. I've got one in the South End. Let me take you down and show you that. Because their studies indicate that 90% of the time, houses without curb appeal cannot be sold to those people. You can lower the price, you can give them a new paint job, you can put in new appliances, and they still won't buy it. That's what the National Association of Realtors has been finding out since the 1940s. In short, that first impression, that curb appeal, that illogical thinking right here and right here, that's what sells houses. If you want to sell your house, by the way, forget all that work out in the backyard. Paint the front, put in some nice flowers. The things you see when you come up to it, they set that first impression. They have 90% of the capability to sell that house. All right, now, given those kind of realities in the world, it seems to me that we have to be experts in human nature. So let's take a look. What is human nature? There are really several elements of human nature that are important to public relations professionals. First, fortunately, humans are curious. They care sometimes about what we're trying to tell them. Sometimes. The trouble is, they are also skeptical. They don't believe what we're trying to tell them. Most importantly, however, humans are social animals. And so the whole peer grouping thing has a large part of it. Fortunately, humans are also educable, so that over time they can learn. We're capable of learning and growing and changing. But, and this is why public relations people will always have a good employment market, human beings are also totally unpredictable. That's what makes it exciting. That's that variable that we just can't get at. Now, there's a sixth characteristic of humans that is very important, and that is that humans are the only creatures that we know of in our world that have the ability to dream. And this is essential. Humans can dream some idea that has never existed before. They can dream a magic marker that has never existed before, and then bring that dream into reality. Now, take a look at this list of characteristics. That's a plus, but that's a minus. That's a plus, and that's a minus. The areas where we as practitioners can change the balance is there, by bringing social pressure, person to person, second step of the two-step flow, peer grouping, and by asking people to dream a little bit, to think big, the big idea. And there never has been a time, I think, when both of those have been so important. When you have no product differentiation, when you're in a present kind of a competitive market, those are the things we can add to the mix that we haven't been adding up until now. Well, let's see how you really feel about this. Let's have you verify or contradict this. Here's a little test. It's kind of a fun test. I think you'll enjoy doing it. But it'll also help, I think, to put some of these things into perspective. Before, or you know, 99 or 101, depending on breakage. Is everybody finished? All right, let's see what we can learn from this. How many of you had the largest single number in the CE column? Okay. Let me see your hands again. Okay. That's interesting. You are the doers, because CE stands for concrete experience. You learn best by actually doing something. Okay? How many of you had RO as the highest category? Yeah, that's about right. You are the philosophers. You learn best by reflective observation. You kind of stand back and you reflect on what you're observing, and out of that you design a system that helps you to learn it. How many of you had AC as the highest? That's rather interesting. You're the planners. AC stands for abstract conceptualization. These are folks who learn best by getting one or two examples solidly in mind, and then from that they abstractly conceptualize the system the way a planner does. Well, how many of you then had AE? Most of you. Well, that's interesting that that would be the highest. Those are the researchers. AE stands for, the E stands for experimentation. And that's rather interesting. This means trial and error, doing by, yes. Ah, that's the question. Did any of you have two categories that were really, you know, 25 points apart or so? No, not apart, apart. No, don't raise your hands, because if you do, you better go see a shrink on the way home. Because the fact is that probably all of you had fairly decent numbers in all of them, and maybe there were 10, 15 points separating them. Because the purpose of this study about learning styles is to demonstrate that to really learn something, all of us go through all four of those processes. We experience it, we experiment with it, we abstractly consider it, we reflect upon it. And the reason that I wanted you to do this little exercise, aside from the fact that I think it's kind of a fun little thing to do, I find it very hard to make choices in most of those categories myself, is because if we want people to learn the good things that we want them to know about the bank and its services and its policies and its reputation and all of those things, we need to find ways to use all four of these methods. Now stop and think what most of our public relations work asks them to do. First of all, we ask them all to be philosophers and to reflectively observe these messages that we're giving them. Or we ask them to be planners. Would you conceptualize based on some examples that we're giving you? We need, as practitioners, to find ways to let them actually experience the bank and its services. Or if they're going to work here, we need a way to let them really feel it as they're being hired and in the orientation process. Or we need to find ways to let them experiment with it, either experience it or experiment with it. I mean, the reason that Procter & Gamble hands out all those little boxes of soap in the mail is a very realistic purpose. They know that that kind of a sample is worth a lot of advertising. It's the reason that you go and drive a car. So what can we do? What kind of things can we build into our public relations programs that get us away from this constant business of sending messages, giving examples, and then expecting people to be planners or philosophers? How many of the people out there are philosophers or planners? Damn few. Most of us are trial and error folks, or we actually, you know, show me, let me experience it. This is really the second step of two-step flow, is finding ways to do this. This is the unexplored, the uncharted area in our field, and notice how close it is again to human nature. I hope everything I'm saying here starts to kind of add up together, because what I'm saying is the same thing using lots of different approaches and lots of different kinds of research. And the thing that I'm saying is that communication is words. Relationships are actions, are doing things. And what can you do in your work with your publics to get some doing into it? There's another piece of information that may help to put this into a little more focus for you. The Cooperative Extension Service, with which you may or may not be familiar, has often been called the most effective organization at motivating people's behavior in the history of the world. They were formed in 1914 by it's a federal government-funded organization, partly. It's the group, the Co-op Extension Service, is the group that deals with the rural farm community to give them extension education. And they're the ones which, since 1914, have helped American farmers learn new techniques, new processes, and go from a day when 80% of the population lived on a farm and each farm could feed 7 people to a day when 3% of the population lives on a farm and each farm can feed 700 people. If you think about that change in a 60-year period, 70-year period, you can see that the education, the behavioral changes, remember, we're talking about farmers now, not your innovators, not your quick change types. And yet they had the techniques to get those people to make those changes, and successfully. And they're the ones who really get that credit. How did they do it? It's interesting, the techniques they use. First of all, they really use diffusion process. They really use this. Let me give you an example, a personal example of how they use diffusion process. I told you I have a blueberry farm up in New Hampshire on a dead-end road looking off at a mountain, dirt road. Not your typical San Francisco type of place. My county agent, my co-op extension agent, would make a phone call to me every often that would go like this. Hi, Pat. Small talk, small talk, small talk. There's a new berry out. It has about 3 times the yield of the ones you're growing. Well, see you around. Awareness. Now, getting that awareness, what do you suppose I did? I picked up that phone so fast and called him right back, and I said, Ed, tell me more about this new berry. My God, you know, don't just call me up and tell me that the thing gives a yield of 3 times. Tell me. Oh, you interested? Well, all right. And he tells me about the new berry. Now, supposing Ed had called me up in the typical way we work without knowing this, without letting me process the awareness and seek the information. Suppose Ed had made a typical phone call. He said, Pat, gee, I just got the information in from these growers. They got this new berry. It has 3 times the yield. It costs $15 a bush. You know, you can do this and this. I'd have put the phone aside, and I'd have said to someone in the house, I'd have said, it's Ed again selling berries. Right? And I'd have said, gee, thanks, Ed. I'll think about it. And I would have hung up. Just think about that. I mean, that's the way we react. But they have actually applied this. And so they'll throw you this little tidbit of information and go away. And inevitably, people are back. Why do teaser ads work? Because people get caught in that. They then want to seek the information. And since we know our blueprint of how the mind works is that that's the way it's going to go anyway, the Co-op Extension Service simply doesn't frustrate it. They go with the system. Well, they've also developed another method that I think is worth all of us knowing. It's their pyramid method of communication in order to lead to behavior. And here is how they do it. They ask 3 questions. Is the audience listening? Is the audience talking? Or is the audience doing? And then they've got a list, which I won't take the time to write up there. All the way from up here in the top of the pyramid is printed matter. And midway down the list will be something like a slideshow, maybe down here with a Q&A, because it's kind of some listening and some talking. You're starting to get the audience involved. And then way down here at the bottom is actual experience and projects. And what they have found over the years is a corollary of 9 to 1 in effectiveness. When you can get people to do something, it is 9 times more effective, even just in an information transfer way, than it is to just give them some printed matter, which they read, listening. After all, reading is listening. Now, their statistics go like this. That people will remember 20% of what they are told, what they are asked to listen to, 20%. They will remember 30% of what they see visually. But they will remember 50% of what they see and hear, which is why Pat Jackson stands up here and writes down half of what he's already told you. And even though you may have trouble deciphering my handwriting, your mind, while trying to decipher it, is focusing on what I said, and so my memorability rate, from what we know about psychology, should go up. However, people will remember 70% of what they say, so if we can find ways to give it back to us, that's why kindergartners and first graders are taught by the rote method. You know? Canada is in North America. Now, Johnny, you say it. Well, Canada is in North America. Well, because they have said it. They have mouthed those words. But people remember 90% of what they do. Now again, analyze our activities. Are we at the high peak of effectiveness, or are we at the low peak? Now, how do you apply some of this? Well, let me give you some examples out of my experience. One of the big topics that's been around the world in recent times is this whole business of local social change. The bank is going to close a branch. The school system is going to close a school. That may not be happening quite as much in California, but I know there's some of it. A new housing development is going to get built on everybody's favorite field out there. And emotions run high, and the whole thing is in a turmoil, and yet the institution involved has to make a decision and has to try and find a symmetrical public relationship solution. Typically, we would just send out a lot of information, explain what we're doing, and it's sort of a too bad. We're going to do it, and here's the reasons. Please try to understand. That's asymmetrical public relations. Then we get a little more sophisticated in what we call meetings, and at least we let people talk. The trouble is, the talking that they're doing is their point of view, not ours, and there's often not much sharing. So we developed a computer game. One particular computer game that we use is in growth, when they're going to build a development in a field or tear down a favorite building and put in, you know, turn an apartment house into condos, all those things that get people emotional. And we will call the opinion leaders involved in that subject together, and we will have them play the computer game. We call it Blackberry Patch. That's the name of this imaginary community. And so we will take the planning official, and he or she will play the role of the developer. And then we will take the developer, and they will play the role of the planning official. And so on down the line. So all these people are in there. And the thing is set up. We've plugged the data in with them. The system is already there, the software. So we say, okay, now, how many units in your development? And then we punch it in. Everybody agrees on all the data. Okay, we get all that in there. And so then they start playing this game. And so the developer, now who's now the planning official, has to question the person playing the role of developer and say, well, wait a minute, what'll that do to the schools? So everybody punches in schools, and up comes the data. Wow, if this development goes in, we're going to need 15 schoolrooms or two teachers or whatever. Or it may say, we can accommodate this. There's room in the community, no problem. But as a result of that gameplay where they're actually in it, we have been able to collapse from sometimes a year and a half or a year down to 3 months a symmetrical decision-making process. Because at the end of that game, believe me, they are there negotiating like 60, trying to work it out, because now the developer sees, hey, my God, I'm asking this town to add, you know, 3 schoolrooms. They can't do that. It's going to cost a fortune, and I'm responsible for it. They're going to hate me. Meanwhile, the environmental group that hated this whole project begins to see some of the developer's point of view, and bingo. They're starting to negotiate and solve the problem. I submit to you, it would have been impossible to do that by any other method. They could shoot message bombs back and forth for 20 years, you know. They could have meetings and argue and go out and have public meetings. What worked was getting them involved. As I said yesterday, the thing that is now the biggest, most effective public relations technique in healthcare and in schools and in higher education is the open house. When we orient freshmen at the University of Tennessee system, we don't orient freshmen. Hell, they'll learn that campus in 20 minutes. They'll know all the bad places to go, quick. We orient freshmen's parents. And if we can swing it, their younger brothers and sisters, who may go back and say, wow, I want to go to that place, when they're still maybe juniors. So we got some pre-selling done. We get them right on campus. And we let them participate. And for those that can't come to campus, we send a roadshow out with live people but video, so we've recreated the campus with maps and all that kind of stuff, but with a live person to call several families together and say, well, we're sorry you can't come to Knoxville or Chattanooga or whichever campus they're going to, but let us show you this. So again, those people are in a CE or an AE mode, and this printed material mode comes along behind it. Now, you got branches all over the state of California. I have a belief that there is a way to use those to start doing this kind of communication and making people believe you and have confidence that sending them stuff in the mail, reaching them through the media, is simply not going to do. I have that belief. The question is whether you feel you can apply it.